Hi, and welcome to Parent Talk, hashtag with Bev. Yes, you remember, I am a Black British mother of West Indian descent living in London with now they're adults. One's 20, one's now 18. As you all have been listening, you know my business. But today, we're just going to be talking about parent engagement. And I have a guest today with me who I met at one of our parent power meetings. And it is, and I'm going to say her name, but I'm going to ask her to also introduce herself as well. It's Dr. Janet Goodall. So welcome, Janet, to Parent Talk, hashtag with Bev. Could you introduce yourself? And the cat's definitely checking in on you. And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very glad to be here virtually. As Bev said, my name is Janet Goodall, and I work for the University of Swansea in the Education Department, School of Education. I'm a mum as well. My kids are a bit older. They're 35 and 33. So well launched in the world and doing great work. So that's kind of me. And I live in South Wales in Swansea.
And you lecture at Swansea University, among other things, as well.
Yeah. I lead our undergraduate program in education, and I also look after our PhD students in education.
Right. So PhD is the those who are going higher than masters. Yes.
Yeah.
just to make sure, I'd never know the profession of the right terms.
Yeah.
You have been working in the education sector. Now, we met last week, but I've heard about you. You know, your name has, you know, everyone's like, you know, Janet Goodall, parent engagement, blah, blah, blah. And I think when I heard you speak on Saturday at our virtual parent power meeting, you said a lot of stuff, some of that we'll cover. But I think it was the fact that you've been working in this area for how long? Like 20 years?
2007, I think. Well, 2006, I think we started. 2005-06, we started the first program, which was called Engaging Parents to Raise Achievement, and it all started from there.
Right. Well, that's still relevant today because people love to use the term, you know, parent engagement, and people have assumptions about what parent engagement is. According to you, first of all, define what you consider to be a parent.
When I use the term parent, what I mean is any adult with a significant caring responsibility for a child, or a young person, which is too long to keep saying.
Yeah.
So I'll say parent, but it could be a foster parent. We know increasingly it's grandparents or other members of the family, aunties, uncles. Sometimes it can be another member of the community. Mm. So it's somebody who is older than the young person who's got a significant caring responsibility.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that's lost because people tend to think that you can only be a parent if you've biologically had a child, but that excludes so many people who have different relationships with young people that are about their education, about their learning. So thanks for defining that because, you know, we're all parents in that respect. Come on, Kitty, you need to move out of the way. But also so what is parent engagement then? Because, you know, you've been working on it for a while. What is it and what is it not? No disrespect in it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, what it is in terms of what actually is effective in helping young people is parents engaging with their young people around their learning. So it's conversations around learning. It's when children are young, it's answering that question. Anybody who's had a five-year-old has spent days answering the question why. It's like that's the first thing they say when they wake up, and they're still saying it when they go to sleep, and I think they say it in their sleep. And it's because they're learning, and parents are engaged in that learning, whoever the parent is or whatever their relation. Anybody who spends time with a five-year-old answers the why question six times an hour, and that's engagement in learning. And it's the same when you're working with a 15-year-old and living with a 15-year-old. sometimes they're still asking why questions that are really difficult to answer. Why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah.
But also, why do I have to do my homework?
Yeah.
Why do I have to come in, you know, why do I have to be in by a certain time? But it's those conversations, and it's an important conversation, even if it's one-sided. So one of the things that we found in working with secondary students was they were really adamant that someone had to ask them how their day went. They had no intention of answering that question, but they said it was important that someone asked because that showed that someone cared.
Right.
And that was the, that's the thing, is saying to a young person, I know you're struggling with this. I'm really proud of you for the fact that you're keeping on with it, even though I know it's hard. Mm. Or I can see you working really hard. Do you want a cup of tea? It's not about parents being able to necessarily help with homework. If you can, that's great. But if you can't help with the homework, it doesn't mean that you're not supporting your children. Mm. Because asking, do you want a cup of tea? Do you think you need to take a break now? Is there anything I can do to help? That is just as important.
You see, I grew up in a West Indian household, okay? And my mother did not really know about the education system. She, you know, it was just like, I've sent you to school to learn. And obviously I know I was learning at home, learned how to cook the Sunday dinner, you know, learned how to keep house, learned how important it was to pay bills and methods of and ways of which we do that. And she never really, and this, you know, I've spoken to my mother about whatever I'm talking about, so it's not like I'm dissing her behind her back, but, you know, she never really paid any attention to the what I was learning at school. All she said was, you're there to learn, and I expect you to come out with whatever they're expecting you to come out with. And some people just felt like, especially my mum's generation, some of them felt like West Indian parents didn't care. And they weren't engaged in their kids' learning, but she was. But, you know, there was this, you know, you need to go and learn this. There wasn't the, I'm going to make you a cup of tea, you know, how's the homework going? You know, she might have said things like, how's your day? But those small things, what I'm hearing you say, those small things are really important to young
people. They are. And what a lot of young people in secondary school told us were things like, I'm not here for my health. I'm here because it's important to my parents. And that's, you know, your mother made it clear to you that education was important. She was expecting you to learn.
Yeah.
And the young people that we've spoken to in our research have picked up on that. They may not ever tell their parents, or at least not while they're living at home. They might come back as adults and say it. But, you know, what they were telling us was that they were there. If I can tell you a story, I love this story. I was working with a group of year eight students. So we were talking about their year seven end of year assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a young woman there, year eight, who said, well, I've got all my certificates from last year. I've got them in a binder in folders. You know this young woman. Everybody, yeah. And the lad at the end of the table, and I could tell what he'd had for breakfast and lunch because it was down his sweat. I raised kids like that. And he looked at me and said, I have no idea where my certificates are. I don't know where they are.
Mm.
I'm going to get a bunch more this year, and I'm going to get a bunch more because that way my dad will come to school and he'll be proud of me.
Oh, yeah.
At which point I was thinking two things. One, don't cry. You're a grown-up researcher. Don't cry. And two, has anybody told this kid's dad that he's trying really hard in school so dad would be proud of him? And we heard that kind of thing over and over and over again. I'm morally certain that young man didn't go home and say to his dad, it's important to me that you're proud of me.
Yeah, no, that's true.
But that's, he wasn't working hard to get good GCSEs. He wasn't working hard to get a good job. He was working hard so his dad would be proud of him.
Yeah. And I think there is a lot that sometimes parents don't say. Like, you know, I think I'm not special, but because of some of the stuff that was not done for me, I've tried to do this for my kids, in the sense of not buy them everything that they want, because they'd be really happy. But my language of love is words of affirmation. And so therefore, you know, when they did stuff, it was very much like, I'm really proud of you. You know, you've done well, you can, but you know, the West Indian side of me was really like, I want you to do really well. You got to work really hard. And if you didn't do, I'm not gonna give you this treat, you know? So it was trying to balance the two. But I felt that it was the things I didn't hear about, I can see that you're working hard. I am proud of you. You're doing well. You know, yes, you didn't get this, you didn't come top of the class today, but there's a tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? And trying to balance that, that was really important. And I think a lot of parents think that that's not strong enough, you know?
And one of the problems we have is that everybody tells parents they're doing it wrong. You know, people will stop parents in the supermarket, or maybe it was just me, you know, and say, you're not doing it right, or that's not what you should do, or whatever. And the world is just full of people telling parents what they should do and how they should do it. And what's really important is that parents love their kids. And that's easy, because you do.
Yeah.
You know, most of the time, you know, you do love your kids and you do want them to do well. And that's what you've actually got in common with teachers as well, is that they want your kids to do as well as they can.
But I think sometimes the school is the battlefield. I'm gonna be honest, you know what I mean? I think, you know, looking at it from my perspective, if I wasn't somebody who had been in education and of a certain ilk, in the sense of, you know, I've got an inquisitive mind and I will stand up and ask questions. But there are a lot of parents, right, who feel intimidated and feel that the teachers have already stereotyped them as aggressive, especially Black people, as aggressive. And the way in which we express ourselves isn't necessarily, I mean, I'm not apologizing for the way we express ourselves. We express ourselves the way we do. Yes, sometimes it can come across quite aggressive look that is, but that's from a position of we're fearful and caring. You know what I mean? We don't understand what's happening. We do not understand what you're saying. We don't understand the data that you're looking at and making your judgments on. And the little that we can do, like go out and work two jobs in order to put food on the table and allow and make the kids manage for themselves, is not that we don't love them, because we wouldn't be out doing two jobs to keep a roof over their head. Do you understand? So how
can I do. And one of the, when I'm working with schools and school teachers, one of the things I say is you need to get rid of this concept of that kind of parent. Whatever that kind of parent is, the vast majority of parents love their kids and want them to do well, and just jettison that kind of parent. And the other thing you often read in the literature or whatever is kids coming into school without social and cultural capital, so without knowing how to do things the way the school wants them to do.
Yeah.
But the reality is that everybody's got social and cultural capital. It's just that the school values some bits more than it values others. So it's not a deficit, but the school often sees it as a deficit. I spend a lot of time kind of ducking behind podiums occasionally. When
you're talking to schools? Because I think the bulk of your work is working with schools in helping them to adjust their lens about how they work with parents.
You're
clearly saying all parents want to be engaged. It's about how you do that. And it's not about the ticking the boxes. To say, you know, X amount of parents attended parent evening, therefore we're doing a great job.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, there's nothing wrong with going into parents evening. Going into parents evening can be a really good thing, but statistically, it has almost no impact on children's achievement, because it's, I mean, how useful are parents evenings? It's one of the things that I do when I'm working with schools, school teachers, is I ask them to think about it as parents. And as parents, how useful are school parents' evenings to you? And generally, they're not terribly enthused about them.
My daughter's hated me going to parent evening.
Yeah. And I remember being told off, very stringently told off, for at least 5 minutes because Caroline wasn't coming to band practice. When the teacher drew breath, I pointed out that Caroline was not my child.
Wow. And that's before pandemic.
At which point Caroline walked up and called me mummy, but that, you know.
You've got how many children? Two?
Two. Neither of whom is Caroline.
Oh my gosh. No. I hear what you're saying. But for some of the parents I've worked with, because I've done family support work and liaison between schools and parents, and I was working for one charity that specifically worked with Black boys, and a lot of the things the parents were saying to me at Parent Day was like, they'd go in, but they'd be scared to ask questions. And when the questions were answered, they weren't answered in a way that was layperson. So they didn't, and because they didn't want to look like they were stupid, they didn't ask, they didn't dig a little bit deeper. What does that actually mean? Well, where is my child in comparison to others? So I was doing a lot of work around trying to demystify and encourage them to be empowered to ask the question. And I remember one parent to ask me to write an email, because I think her child was having, they were worried about educational needs, and she'd been sitting on it for about a year, and I was like, okay, well, he has an educational psychologist report, so what we do is we're just going to write to the school and ask them what action has been taken on this, what things have been put in place to support, how has that been monitored by the teachers, and how has that been fed back to the parents, and how are the school and the parent working together? And let's copy in the educational psychologist to this email, because the mother had been trying, but it hadn't worked. I'll tell you something, one email sent out like that, the next thing the mother says to me, oh, we've got a meeting and they're explaining this and they're doing that and the plan is working. And, you know, thank you so much. And I was like, I did really nothing. You were more courageous to follow that through. Yes, you had another eye on the issue. But if we didn't talk about that as parents, or if we didn't have a space to go, we wouldn't be able to have some sort of victory, and I mean that in a different sense, but, you know, a little bit of victory. So it released that mother to be able to feel empowered to support. It improved the relationship with the school, and it also let the school know that somebody else was watching this whole scenario. And I think sometimes schools are frightened of other people watching the way in which they may do something.
And I think as well, I think a lot of, you know, school teachers go into school every day. It isn't a frightening place for them. Mm. And I go into an awful lot of schools, and I spent 20 minutes just before the pandemic wandering around a school, an infant school, because someone had said you need to go to the bunny classroom. Every classroom had the bunny classroom. Every classroom had bunnies on it. I had no idea. Now, to the member of staff, the member of staff knew precisely which classroom was the bunny classroom. Mm. I, as an outsider, had no idea. Mm. Bunny classroom was. And teachers, I think, often forget how intimidating schools are for an awful lot of people. And particularly if your experience of school wasn't a happy one.
Exactly.
Then that's going to bring up all of those memories for you. And I keep saying to teachers, you're trying to build, to repair bridges that other people broke. Because those, you know, the teachers in the schools now may be really wonderful people, but parents are remembering the teachers that made them feel small, or the teachers that shamed them.
Yeah.
And the teachers that are in the school now have to realize that those experiences are there and they're real. And in my experience, when I've talked to teachers and explained that, they've all gone, oh, wow, oh, okay. And sometimes it can be really simple things, like just put a video of the empty school on the website so people know what it's going to look like when they walk in.
Yeah.
That takes away a lot of the anxiety. If you know, explain the security systems. You know, if you go into a secondary school anymore, you're very likely to have your picture taken, or what's happening to the picture. Yeah. Where is it going to go? How long is it kept? You just explain that those systems are there to protect the children. It's not that they're trying to keep parents out. They're trying to keep out people that might be dangerous to the children. That doesn't include parents, but they don't necessarily know on site who is and who isn't a parent.
Well, I mean, you've brought up a really important point, because it's the first impression, isn't it? And it is about communicating. Simply, it's a simple communication, because I was thinking about when I was going to talk to you, and I was like, well, how do, because the, fundamentally it's about trust. So how do I trust you with the precious treasure that I've given you? You know, and I say to parents, you, not all parents, but you know your child more than others. Yeah. And so if I'm going to give a gift to you, I'm going to explain a little bit about, you know, especially how my child reacts to criticism, because I've criticized them. So I know, you know, I know what works for my eldest. She didn't like embarrassment. So if you raised your voice, so I didn't have to hit her. I didn't have to do discipline in that way. I learned discipline another way, because I knew what she didn't like. So if we went out to the shop and she was misbehaving, all I did was raise my voice. And she was like, oh my God. So when I went to the school, I said, all you need to do if she's being disobedient is raise your voice. She doesn't like that. But parents kind of feel like, I've given my child to you. You bring it back with something with added. And I think what you're saying is, yes, but we've still got to work together. So communicate on both sides, what the child's like, what the school's like, so that we can work together on learning, because you are teaching, but I as a parent am teaching my kids, but I'm teaching them something different, but it's still learning, which is what you sort of touched on.
Yeah, and it's all learning. I mean, one of the schools that we worked with a few years ago, when children came into reception, they asked parents to basically fill in a form, not about, you know, can your child spell their name or whatever, because that's quite easy to find out, but what's important to your child, you know. And it, parents wrote down things like, we'll do anything for a dinosaur sticker. Well, that's important to know.
Yeah,
you know. And when I did some work in Scotland with parents, and I asked parents, what do you want teachers in the school to know about your children? Over two thirds of what parents wanted their teachers to know was not about anything academic. It was about, we're a church going family, or we do a lot of walking, or we're a very musical family, or she really likes skating, or, you know. And as you say, you know your children differently. Yeah. You know, I've sat in parents' evenings listening, thinking, are we talking about the same child?
Well, you know, our kids do, I don't know about anybody else, but my children love to change the script. I think I suddenly know, and then suddenly at school, they're a different individual. And I'm like, who is that child? Because the one who comes home telling me all their issues and they're starving and they're hungry and whatever, whatever, is not the child that's presenting at this to this teacher. But there was something else you said at Parent Power that was, because we were talking about, you said engaging with parents is an issue of social justice.
Yes, I think it is.
Why?
Because the school system we have at the moment in the UK is inequitous. You can look at how...
What's the inequitous?
It's unequal.
All right.
It's unfair. You can look at the vast majority of kids coming out of secondary school. You can look at their results and you can figure out what their background is. And we have a gap. It's called a socioeconomic gap. Kids from better off families tend to do better in the school system that we have. And I don't think that's fair, because it's not down to the children. The children haven't made those choices. The children haven't, you know, it's not down to the children. And it's also not universal. There are countries in the world where you can't tell what somebody's background is by looking at their achievements. Mm. And that's why I think it's an issue of social justice, because we need to support families as well as supporting kids. I mean, young people are in school maybe 25% of the time, if that. And when I say in school, I mean not necessarily physically in school, but studying or whatever.
Right.
The rest of the time, they're with their families, they're with the community, they're with their friends. And some people benefit more from the school system than others. And part of that's because of what they're bringing in. And I would really like everybody to be able, both the system to change to accommodate everybody who's coming in, and support parents and families to support their kids going into the system.
So let me just be devil's advocate here for a minute. People are going to say, teachers are going to say, I'm a teacher, I'm not a social worker. I don't have to work with the whole family in order. My job is to specifically teach that child, you know, how to do this particular aspect of the curriculum. Why is it important for me to suddenly embrace the whole family? All right, that's what some teachers are going to say. And some parents are going to be like, you know, at the end of the day, if you can't be bothered to be involved with what's happening in the school, then that's your own hard chips, your own hard luck. What would you say to either of those?
For the teacher, I would agree entirely they're not social workers. They shouldn't be asked to be social workers. And I think some of the stuff we ask teachers to do is unfair because they're not supported or trained for it. But that doesn't mean just engaging with the family is not about being a social worker. It's about realizing the child or the young person doesn't exist only in school.
Right.
The child or young person exists. And what's interesting is if I say this to people who work in early years or people who work in primary, they look at me like, why are you saying something that is that obvious? Because anybody who worked in primary or early years can tell as a child walks in whether they've had a good day at home or a bad day at home. But that doesn't change when children get to secondary school, when young people get to secondary school. They're still enmeshed in their families, they're still enmeshed in their friends groups, they're still enmeshed in their peer groups. And it's still important that everybody who's around the child or young person is engaged in supporting their learning. It doesn't mean parents have to help with the economics homework or the German homework or whatever, but it doesn't mean that parents have to know the content. What I said on Saturday, it's not about parents knowing the answer, it's about parents caring that the answer gets found.
No, I hear that. I just don't think we hear that enough.
Do you understand? I agree with you entirely.
We just don't hear that enough, because I know people are going to be listening to this and they're going to still be like, you know, saying, well, actually, that isn't enough. Schools need to do more, and some schools, you know, boy, I don't want to out certain schools, but there are certain schools, it's almost like it's our way or the highway. If your hair isn't the right cut, if your uniform or skirt, you know, we're not even talking about your education or what you're learning. We're talking about if you cannot stop fidgeting in the line, then you're not coming into this building, which a lot of parents that I have been dealing with, you know, they get calls every day about small things, in inverted commas, like that, which wear them down. Oh, I hate this phone being connected to this thing. Sorry. Which wear them down. And so they're so worn down, they're just like, I can't even be bothered to engage with the school because the school's not even listening.
I wish I had an answer for that. I do hear you and I agree. And I think we have definite issues around a lot of these things where we have, one of the things that I challenge school leaders with is every school has a school improvement plan.
Yeah.
And I challenge school leaders to change that to a learning improvement plan. Because schools exist for learning. They don't exist for any other reason. And it's always interesting when I do that, couple of heads, you can see light bulbs going on over some people's heads. Because the school is there to support learning. It does a huge amount of other stuff, but that's what the school is there for. And that's what parents have been doing since the first time they encountered their child. We do actually have something in common.
Look, you've said, or we've been saying, you know, it is a two-way relationship, and it's about us working together with the school and the school working together with us. So if I've got a mum listening or a parent listening now who's having an issue, let's say, with the school, and they feel that they're not listening, what kind of advice might we suggest to try and begin the improvement of a relationship between the school and the family?
I think that the key there is the word relationship, and thinking about it as a relationship. Mm. And the problem is often by the time we get to the point of this, the relationship's already in a bad state and everybody is feeling defensive or whatever. And teachers can feel that way as well. Mm. You know, everybody involved in this is human. And I've worked with more teachers than parents in this situation, but some of the teachers I know that have been in this sort of situation have picked up the phone and said, "You're concerned about your child. I'm concerned about your child. How do we work together?"
Yeah.
You know, everybody wants the same thing, which is the best outcome for the child.
Yeah.
And there's no magic formula in doing this, simply because it's about relationships, and each individual will be different. Each person will be different. The other thing that can be really hard for parents to remember, and as a parent, I at times had trouble remembering this as well, is that teachers are human as well. Mm-hmm. And yes, they are in a position of power, but it's interesting. When I ask teachers who has the power in parents' evenings, they always say it's parents. And parents always say it's teachers. So I think it may be the janitor. I'm kind of convinced it's the janitor.
But my daughters, especially the youngest, because she'd already seen the way I'd done it with the eldest, she was very much like, "Mom, I don't want you to come to the parent evening." And I was like, "No, all right. So I used to work in education. I also was a parent governor for about 10 years. So I've seen both sides of the coin. And so therefore, when I go into parent evening, I'm looking at how you're stretching my child. And how is she performing in comparison to your expectation? And what is your expectation of my child? Tell me what that is, because if it doesn't marry with mine, then we have a slight problem. And also there is the whole thing of lack of expectation among certain teachers of certain groups of children because of certain assumptions. So I go into parent evening with all of this, and a notepad and a pen, and I had questions. And I think it's important as well. Sometimes we're not brave enough to think on our feet. So it's good to have some questions that you write down yeah. before you get to parent evening, or before you get to that meeting, or before you get engaged with that school. Like when we were looking for schools, we were asking, you know, writing questions down about what they did. We should still carry that on. You know, I remember one teacher, he was like praising my daughter, and I was like, "Yes, you're doing really well. I'm really proud of you. I'm saying it in front of everybody. Yes, I am proud of you." And then I said to him, "So what's the extension and stretching exercises? Because her vocabulary needs to improve." He looked at me like, "Oh my God, I can't please you." And my daughter was like, "Oh, couldn't we just finish with the praise?" You know?
Yeah. And it's one of the schools that we worked with in Somerset started sending home questions that parents could ask at parents' evening, but they also gave teachers questions that teachers could ask at parents' evening. So tell me something about your child. I mean, because a lot of times at parents' evening, you go in and sit down and they read you a report that they sent you last week.
Yeah.
And part of that's because they're trying to get through everything and they've got a responsibility and all that. But this school had questions for parents like, what can we do to support our child? Where can we, you know, is there anything specific we should be doing in specific subjects? And for teachers, it was things like, tell me something about your child that will help me to help them. Because you know your child differently. It's what we said before. And I remember one teacher telling me that one of my children was really, really quiet. It's like, that child's never been quiet in their life.
Right.
But the child was not enjoying that subject mm-hmm. and therefore just kind of zoned out.
Yeah. I remember what helped me was when the children came home from school. So there's two things. I think everybody pours a lot of stuff into primary school and mm-hmm. primary years, but they do less for secondary. And I think secondary years, year 7 to 13, are challenging in different ways. And parents still need to be logged on. Yeah. And so my job was made redundant, and I then had time to rethink how. And it happened at the time when they were at secondary, beginning of their years at secondary. So I said, I'm going to make a conscious decision to work part-time. I was able to, not everybody is. But what was the key thing that changed for us was I now had mental space to be able to ask the question, how was school? And spend 15 minutes as soon as when we hooked up. So what happened for you today in school, and how was it? What worked for you, and what wasn't really working? And that helped me to build up a picture of how my children were coping with school. So when I went to a parent evening and they'd say certain things, I had all that information. But if I hadn't spent the 15 minutes, and this isn't about, oh, how fantastic I am as a mother. Do you know what I mean? I think at the end of the day, I was in a position to be able to do that. And I'm just trying to encourage other parents that if you can ask how and sort of somehow retain some of that information, that helps you when you start to engage with the school. Because if the school presents a particular thing and the children present a different thing, then we need to look at how we marry that together. And a lot of my work was about that with the liaison stuff. So I think we've covered a lot of on that. You talked about this. I like this one that you talked about, aspirations and the myth.
Yeah. That's a big, just before we go on to that,
yeah,
there are a lot of different ways of asking that question, by the way, of how was school.
Please.
Tell me two things that you had. Tell me two best things. Tell me two things that you know now that you didn't know yesterday. And if as a family, you're all together at some point eating dinner or watching TV, everybody in the family can do that.
Right.
Grandma, tell me two things that you know today that you didn't know yesterday. With teenagers, they may have found out stuff that you're not keen on them finding out, but but it also models for everybody that everybody's still learning.
That's a really important tip.
Really good. The thing about aspirations is there's a very persistent myth that that groups of people don't have educational aspirations for their children. Mm-hmm. And it showed up in the literature about 50 years ago, and it was debunked in the literature about 49 years ago, because it takes about a year to publish an academic article.
Right.
Academics know it's not a thing, but policymakers love the idea that everybody in this group has high aspirations for their children, and everybody in this group doesn't have any educational aspirations for their children at all. Mm. And there's a paper by Professor Morag Trainor, which is Treanor, mm-hmm, called "Can We Put the Myth of the Poverty of Aspirations to Bed Now?" And Morag's a professor at Harriet Watt, and she's a statistician, among other things. And that paper brings together all the evidence that shows that it's a myth.
Right.
Whole groups of people don't care about education. That's a complete, you could say that the group of people who don't care about education don't care about education, but that's about all you can say. You can't say that this ethnic group or that religious group or that age group or whatever. But it's a very prevalent myth, and you hear it a lot. So it takes a good deal of debunking.
So we're continuing with the debunking here. All parents, no matter where you come from, what's your economic background? You have aspirations for your kids. They know it. You know it. So don't listen to them when they say anything about the fact that whatever you are, you don't have the aspiration. That's all a lie. The other thing
is that not all aspirations are university. One of the things, when you go to a lot of schools, they'll have a list of these are our children that made it to Oxbridge, or these are our children. And I keep asking them to take those down, because what I want is a list of these are our children who followed their dreams.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And for some of them, it may be getting into an elite university. That's great. We'd love to see them. Send them to Swansea. That's great. We'd love them. But we need plumbers, and we need electricians, and we need hairdressers. And I remember one had teachers saying to me that, you know, ambitions were ambitions and David Bowie needed a hairdresser. And it's a really, really good point. This was when David Bowie was still alive.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not, for some children, university is exactly where they should be and it's great, but it's not necessarily for everybody. And for some people, following their dreams is what they should be. Well, for everybody, following their dreams is what they should be doing. And that's what we should be applauding.
Well, you see, some people might say you're living in a fantasy world, because the reality is that, you know, as a Black woman, right, my parents were like, you need to get the best education. You know, there are still parents, even within the parent power group, you know, their aspirations that their kids get to Oxford or Cambridge, what the hell they do when they get there. Because sometimes what happens, one of the programs I was involved with was that we would, children who were academically bright and able were able to apply for scholarships and bursaries to some of these prestigious private schools. And I know a few Black young boys who have gone there. But the big issue for me personally was that parents felt like it was an achievement that they got into the school because the child's bright. You've seen, my child is bright. They go in there and then they leave them there. And the problem is that the culture in those schools is geared towards white upper middle class, because if you're going classes, it's upper middle class. And many of them do not know about the cultural capital that that young person has developed or had instilled in them from living in the urban so-called setting to get them through. And the parents think because they're there, they've made it. And I've had to go and visit these young boys and they're dealing with some issues that their parents need to be involved in, but everyone's scared of losing the scholarship. You know, I'm not outing any parents, but, you know, they're frightened of losing the scholarship and they leave the young person there. And then I've seen the young person have to redefine their identity, which means denying who they really and where they're coming from and their community in order to survive the 5 or 6 years that they're going to be there. And then they come out and they come back to us in our community and they can't relate.
And it's, it's an issue that we need to be a lot better with. And that's why when I was talking to Parent Power, I had that final slide. It starts with children on different size boxes so they can see over a fence. And the final slide is not having the fence at all.
Exactly.
And it's, I agree, it's utopian and we're not going to get there in my lifetime. But yeah, and we need to be honest about the issues in the first place and acknowledge them, that they exist.
And I think, you know, you are thinking, or what you're speaking about speaks with me, you know, because my mother was like, you need to have a job and what are you going to do? And it was like this. Whereas with my children, I have been saying to them, follow your dreams, wherever your passion is. If you're going to go university, do a subject that you feel passionate about, because at some point you're going to hate the damn subject anyway. And the passion is the only thing that's going to get you through, right? The other thing I've said to them is, you know, if you go and you don't like it, there's never too late to change the subject, and it's never too late to defer for the year and come back when you feel more able. I said to my youngest, I said, you've got 3 options. One is you can go to university, do an apprenticeship, or find a job. You know, these are all things that you can do. You know, university, you don't have to go. But, you know, if other people in the family heard that that was what I was saying, they'd be like, how could you not, you know? And it's more important that, as you say, follow your dreams, because the dreams will present opportunities that you will see because you're following that dream. And those things can lead you to places you've never even known. You know what I mean? It's being brave as a parent. I think what you're asking us to do is be braver in asking questions, getting to know, informing people about our kids, but also being brave enough to say to them, follow your passion. I'm still proud of you. I still, you know, I still think that I'm here to support you no matter what, which way you're going, as long as it's within the law. And, you know, at the end.
Precisely what I said to my kids. Yeah. And
exactly.
I remember talking to a group of teachers in Scotland at one point, and everybody who was in the conversation had at a parent's funeral. Everybody kept coming up and telling them how proud their parents had been of them, but they never heard it from their parents.
No, it's too late, man.
You know, and there are a lot of parents are worried that their kids get big-headed or, you know, too proud or whatever. And it's a decision that each parent has to make for themselves. But there is there's a lot of research around student self-belief.
Yeah.
And young people believe they can learn, then they're much more likely to learn.
And I think that's your work and the work that I'm doing with parents within my community and others, is that we want to get that message across, that you want your passion, your desire to learn is there. And we believe in it, and we believe in you. Whatever's the blockage, let's try and work on it. Let's try and be honest enough to say, the cat was interrupting me. Be honest enough and brave enough. And sometimes that is the hardest thing to do. The simple things are the hardest things to do. And as a Black woman, growing up, my mother was always about, as a Black person, you have to work twice as hard. You can't afford. It wasn't that I couldn't afford to have a passion, but it was really important that I worked hard and got a job and I stuck with it. And I think that it's a change now. What I'm asking my kids to do is change. And some people listening to this will say, well, it's okay for you, but it's not going to work. And especially now that we're post-pandemic, where we're uncertain about the future, and everybody's worried about the amount of education that their children have lost, and what's going to be done about it. Hearing someone say, follow your dreams, and that, you know, we're proud of you, and let's be a bit brave and courageous, might seem like a bit too risky.
But it's, I mean, one of the standpoints of feminism in the 70s, which I actually remember because I'm very old, was denying the dichotomy. It's not either or, you know. And if, for example, university doesn't, you don't have to go into university when you're 17 or 18. I came into university working in adult education.
Yeah.
And I had students that were in their 70s and their 80s, who were fantastic students to teach, because they were bringing an entire lifetime's views to what they were doing. But I remember one student saying to me, when I worked on a very leafy campus with a lot of parkland, that she used to bring her kids picnicking to the campus, and said that one day she'd get a degree from there. And everybody kind of said, yeah, mum. She did.
She did. Yeah.
She was mid-60s, early 70s, but she did it.
And it's never too late. I think that's the thing with the parent power group. So there's quite a few parents, because we're all supporting and because we're networking and sharing opportunities that we all are hearing about, which adds to this culture of capital, so that our children are benefiting from the networks. I mean, my daughter just got accepted to Transatlantic Leadership Program. I didn't know about it. Somebody had posted it in one of the groups. I sent it to my daughter. She acted upon it. They interviewed her. They love her. She's like, oh, they want me on the advisory board. They're going to give me training. And I'm like, if more of us could have networks of supportive parents and get rid of those who are the drama, those who are scared, they're not ready. And it's not even, when I say get rid of, it's not like I forget about them, because they need more time and more work in order to reach a place where some parents may be. But it's inspired me. And just talking more with other parents, it's important that we have these hubs of parent support, whether schools are the right place for them, but we need to feel like we're not alone and we're not isolated. And we need people like you who are doing the research and coming up with new and simple ideas that they're simple, but they're effective. That's what we need, clear thinking. And I was looking at some of your stuff. You've got like 100 ideas for secondary teachers. I think I saw that on...
this is really sad, isn't it? Terribly, terribly sad.
They're right at your hand and you can pick them up.
That one's for secondary and there's one for primary as well.
Yes.
That is the same book, but in Indonesian, which really, really impressed us.
Oh, brilliant.
I can't read it, but it's been translated and that makes me very happy. These are really simple. They're just books that you would dip into for simple ideas, one's for secondary and one's for primary teachers. But there are online resources as well. If you find the books on Bloomsbury, on their website, they're online resources. You don't have to buy the book to use them.
I think what I'm going to do, if I can, is link some of your freebies to the website so that other parents will be able to find it quite easily in case they're not able to navigate their way around it, all of the internet. We were just going to have a conversation, but back of my head, we've said a lot of stuff, a lot of tips for parents, and I do want to wrap it up because people stop listening after a certain amount of time anyway. If you had any tips for parents about engaging with schools, we've said quite a lot of them, but is there anything that you feel that you don't want to, that you haven't said, that you don't want to regret not saying?
Start from the position that everybody wants the same thing, which is the good of the child. And it is, there's a children's story where I can't remember what the story is, but somebody is very much afraid of something. And then it turns out that whatever they're afraid of was afraid of them as well.
Yeah.
And teachers can be just as worried about dealing with parents as parents are about dealing with teachers, and everybody's overworked. But starting from, I know you want the best for my child. I want the best for my child.
Yeah.
You know, because I think the vast majority of teachers do.
Well, I think I'll label the podcast, I want the best, you want the best. Let's work together. Something around that kind of way. Janet, I want to say thank you so much for taking time out of this hot, lovely day to have a little bit of a natter with me. I'm sure that if there are any other questions, the question I have to ask is, would you be happy to do this again in the future? You know, especially if we want to reach out to particular parents.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And I just want to say a big thank you. I learned a lot from listening to you at the Parent Power, and I'm hoping that the listeners will do exactly the same. So thank you for your time, and it's have a brilliant weekend, and we'll keep in touch. Let me stop this. So thanks, listeners, for your time today. You have been listening to Dr. Janet Goodall and myself nattering away about education. I'd like to say be safe, take care of yourselves as we're coming out of the pandemic, and I'll be back next week with another podcast. Bye.